Welcome back to another episode of the Grow a Fan Base podcast. I do not have a guest today. I'm doing something a little bit different. I'm starting kind of a new track or series, if you will, called The Playbook, where it's all unscripted. I have some notes, but it's unscripted, unrehearsed, and it's a little bit about me and my story, so you can kind of learn about why the heck are you even doing this, and who are you to even do this? A, I'm a nobody, but B, I've done a few things, failed a lot, and if you want to talk baseball analogies, I mean, I've struck out a lot in business and life, but I've also hit a few what I'll call singles and doubles and maybe a triple here and there. No home runs or grand slams yet. We'll see. But my thought is to help and to share my story and things I've learned along the way, strategies, business strategies, marketing strategies, and kind of just to give a break. One of the hardest things, to be quite honest, and this is where I'm going to go off the rails because it's unscripted, the hardest thing to do on this podcast is to actually find the guests and lock them in. So I wanted to stay consistent in the fact that every other week I will launch a playbook, and then on the other weeks I will try to find a guest for you to enjoy. So I hope you enjoy a little bit about my story. Son, I'm going to teach you a lesson. Now, those were the first words out of my dad's mouth when I had asked him to borrow $250 for a pair of shoes. Now, hold on, hang in there with me. I was 12 or 13 years old at the time, and these just weren't any pair of sneakers. They were a sample of the Nike Air Jordan 5th Edition Retro White and Silver. Now, you may be thinking, okay, $250 for a pair of shoes is insane, which even today, that is a lot of money for a pair of shoes. But at age 12, 13, this was 1998 or so, if I can do my math. I was born in 84, so 96, 97, right? So I needed to buy this pair because I thought, or kind of knew, that I could sell them for more than $250. So what would happen is Nike reps would go around and they would show the upcoming Air Jordans, Nikes, all, you know, everything that was coming out either, you know, later that year or even next year to all of their accounts. And then when these guys and girls were done showing all of their accounts and getting their orders, they didn't really have a huge use for the shoes, so they would have sample sales. And this was one of those, like, you just had to either know the right people or do the networking or the, you know, the research to find out when these reps were doing sales. Put it this way, I would buy the newspaper and I would look in the classified section to see if there were any announcements for Nike sample sales, Adidas sample sales. Adidas, unfortunately, at the time wasn't as like crazy as Nike was. Actually went to high school with the daughter of an Adidas rep, but they just weren't really moving like Nikes and Air Jordans were. So if you could get your hands on a sample pair of Jordans that were coming out like a year from now, that was gold. Like, you could sell those bad boys, you know, for $500, $600, $700, $800. So my dad agreed to loan me the $250. And I remember him saying, son, whatever happens, if you get ripped off, whatever happens, you are paying me back the $250. You're cutting the grass. You're doing everything you need to do. You're going to pay me back. And I mean, I had already, basically, I'm halfway up the stairs by now. And so I was in, and this is going to sound really creepy, but I was in Instant Messenger on AOL, right? And I was chatting with this guy who lived in Florida who had gone to a sample sale, and he probably paid $50 to $80 for these shoes. So he's selling them to me for $250. So he's making his money. Well, I said, okay, man, I'll take them. So This is, like I said, 1996, 1997-ish. So you don't Venmo somebody money. You don't send anything. PayPal maybe was around, but I had to go get a money order from the bank and then physically mail him a money order. Now, if you remember money orders, like, they're just as good as cash. And so he could have just cashed that money order. I mean, I've never met this guy. I mean, I was living in up in Indiana at the time. Never met the guy. And he could have just taken my money, right? I'm a 13-year-old kid. I think he was in his 20s, which sounds really crazy. But he actually sent the shoes. So then he mailed me the shoes. They checked out. They were legit. They were 100% real. And I remember at the time, there was also a guy, Jersey Joe. And he had a website. He lived in Jersey. And there's actually a Nike headquarters based out of Jersey. So he had a ton of samples. And he had a following and the ability to sell high-end sneakers. And I would talk to Joe. Again, this sounds crazy. I'm 13. Joe was in college at the time. But him and I would converse back and forth. And he told me, he said, hey, I think I can probably get $750 for your shoes, you know, and charge you a commission and all that. So when I got them, I actually sent them straight to Joe. Well, I also, and I'm really going to date myself here, I also got a disposable camera and I took two or three photos of the shoes. And then I had to actually ride my bike, no joke, ride my bike up to CVS and do the like 1 hour, you know, film thing. And then if you remember CVS, and I think they still maybe have them, but CVS had a scanner, a Kodak scanner that you could actually scan photos and save them to a 3.5-inch floppy disk. There were no memory sticks, no anything. You're saving those photos to a 3.5-inch floppy, which held like two or three photos, which was about all the space they had on there. So I did that, got my 3.5-inch floppy disk, rode my bike back home. This is kind of like the walk uphill both ways story, but got back home, put it into our gateway computer, did the whole dial-up internet thing, logged on to a message board called Nike Park. And Eric, maybe you're listening. You and I still keep in touch today. But Eric had probably one of the most famous websites, sneaker websites of all time for that era in the 90s, a website called Nike Park. And he had a message board where people would post things for sale and talk about sneakers and break, you know, here's the next Jordans coming out and all that stuff. So I posted my photos that I had these, this sample, and I was willing to take $750 for them, right? So remember, I paid $250. Well, within 30 minutes of posting, I had an email from Hiroshi Senju. Hiroshi lived in Hiroshima, Japan, and he said, I will take your samples for $750 plus $30 to ship to Japan. And I just remember reading that email going, you've got to be kidding me, right? So I run downstairs. Well, first, before running downstairs, I had already mailed the shoes to Joe, and so I sent Joe a message, and I was like, hey, I think you're going to need to send those shoes back because I believe I just sold them. And I told him who I sold them to. And actually, that was one of his customers. Just random coincidence. He's like, oh, man, that's like one of my best customers. So Joe then mailed the shoes back. But I ran back downstairs and I'm like, Dad, you'll never guess what just happened. I sold the shoes for $750 to some guy in Japan. And my dad literally had one question for me. He said, son, how many more of those can you get? And I just remember that began, one, my love for entrepreneurship. And two, I was already interested in sneakers. And I'll kind of tell you why here in a second. But that's really what kicked off everything for me, was just that, I'll call it like a rush of being able to like do that deal. sell the sneakers, make the money, and just learn how all that worked. And so it all checked out, actually. Hiroshi sent me a USD money order, kind of the same process. He sent me a money order, cashed it, everything went through, and I mailed him the shoes. Well, long story short, I'm sitting in a sneaker chat room. Yes, that was a thing. I was a nerd, still am, but I was a nerd. I was sitting in a sneaker chat room like on a Friday night, and this guy went by the handle AC, and I think it was AC77. And come to find out, his real name was Andy Chang, and Andy was in college at the time, and he was renting the basement of a Nike basketball employee. I think he was like the head of marketing or something. He was high up, and he would literally bring home duffel bags. And Andy was into sneakers too, so he would bring home like duffel bags full of samples, what they call look-see samples, which are kind of like more of prototypes where there's something, it's very early on, or there's like a colorway that they're testing. So basically what would happen is, you know, let's take Michael Jordan, for example. Michael has to approve, you know, the shoes and the colors and, the run everything by him. So he's sitting in a room. They roll in all these prototype sneakers, different designs, colors, etc. And he goes, I don't really like this colorway, or like, hey, can we make this a darker navy, or, you know, this and that, the other. And they would literally just toss the sneakers, or, you know, this guy would bring them home and stuff like that. So, again, long story short, I'm terrible at telling stories because I go off in tangents and I get excited. But Andy's in this chat room talking about all the stuff that he has and willing to sell. And I mean, I'm talking about stuff made for like Eminem, Jay-Z, all these NCAA teams. So they would like take a popular shoe and they'd, you know, make it in an unreleased color for the Kentucky basketball team or Duke or certainly UNC, since that's where Jordan went. And then they would also do it for professional athletes, right? So Warren Sapp, Eddie Jones, like all these guys who didn't have shoe deals, but like were still good enough to where they would make custom colors. So they would take, like for Warren Sapp, they'd take a pair of Jordans. He was playing on the Buccaneers at the time. They would, you know, make them in his colors for his team. And then they would stitch, instead of 23, they would stitch 99 on the back, and put Sapp's like initials on them somewhere and, you know, make them specifically for him. So I send Andy a little DM, basically, like I was slid into his DM before that was a thing. So I sent him like a side message and I was like, hey man, do you really have all this stuff that you're saying that you have? And, you know, can you prove it? Like, can you send me some photos? And so he starts sending me photos of all this stuff that he has. And I was like, I'll take it, man. Like, what do you want for it? Turns out, so Andy and I, and unfortunately I've lost touch with Andy. So Andy, if you happen to be listening to this, man, hit me up. Like, I would love to reconnect. But Andy and I basically formed a partnership to where, I mean, he would sell everything to me that he would get. And I built a website called theshoecenter.com, and I was selling rare and hard to find Air Jordans and Nikes all throughout high school and even some into college, for thousands of dollars. And he was selling them to me, this is gonna blow your mind, for like $100, $150. And Hiroshi actually became one of my best customers. So the guy that bought the first pair became one of my best customers over time. And this guy was paying $1,500, $1,800. The most I ever sold, I think, was like $1,800, which today, that's not that crazy for sneakers. It's crazy for me. I would never pay $1,800 for a pair of shoes. I'm now in the like $75 category. But back then, as a 15-year-old and someone's willing to give you $1,800 for a pair of shoes that you paid $100 for, that's a darn good profit. So come to find out, Hiroshi had a store downtown Hiroshima, Japan, and was selling these bad boys for twice what he was buying them from me. So if you know anything about Japanese culture, they love Western culture. Levi's, G-Shock watches, and Nikes and Air Jordans are huge. At least they used to be. I haven't really kept up with it lately. But they really loved like what, you know, Americans had, and they were willing to pay for it. So Hiroshi had a store called Fun Key. So funky, but F-U-N-K-E-Y. And he was reselling all these sneakers downtown Hiroshima, Japan, which I just felt and thought was like incredibly cool. Just if you think about the layers, right? Andy selling them to me. Me to, now I've forgot it, Hiroshi. Hiroshi, Hiroshima, it all starts to run together. And then he was reselling it to his customers. So if you think about all those layers, that's pretty cool and kind of crazy. But yeah, so Andy and I have created that partnership, built the website, and that's how I learned basically how to build a website, and all self-taught. And just had the drive, had that passion for figuring it out. I learned photography. So I, you know, would ask other people, and I, in just like talking with other guys that were taking really good pictures of shoes, and like, how did you do that? And I mean, I remember old, like using old desk lamps and getting the lighting just right, and buying fluorescent light bulbs, and oh, all sorts of stuff. And digital cameras weren't really like a thing. I mean, they kind of started to become a thing. So I had a Sony Mavica, if you remember those. The 3.5-inch floppy went into the cameras. There was no memory card or anything like that. You put a 3.5-inch floppy into that thing. And not a whole lot of settings. So, I mean, now, you know, you've got all these crazy Sonys and all that where you're dialing up, you know, the ISO, the shutter speed and all that. The Mavica's basically said, I'm on, and you can hit a button and take a photo. So again, long story short, that's kind of how I got into marketing. That's kind of how I got into entrepreneurship. You know, I mean, all these guys that are coming on the podcast and all my friends, some of them I've known for 20, 30 years now, maybe not 30, I'm only 39, that would be weird, but 20 years or so. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, dude, you're grow up, man, you're, you got a Peter Pan complex, like you're still into sneakers and all that. I am. I love the sneakers, one, for the business side of it, but two, I also really like design. And I love stories. And if you actually go back, and you know, now Nike has the movie out about like signing Jordan and all that. But if you look at majority of like the Air Jordans, they're designed around items. So, and particularly items that are important to Jordan. So some are, you know, designed around his watches. Some are designed around some of his cars and motorcycles. There's some that are designed around animals, like panthers and stuff like that. And so I enjoy like the story side of the design. And two, it reminds me of kind of simpler times, to be quite honest with you, when I was, I'm not so much into it now. I like to read what's coming out and stuff like that. But when I was into sneakers, it was super simple. And we would camp out in front of a finish line, and we knew the manager, and you kind of had to network that way. And your parents had to drive you there. They used to come out on Wednesdays, and stores would open early to allow for kids to come and get them and stuff like that. So for me, it reminds me of my childhood and just growing up, simpler times. So that is why, one of the big reasons why I enjoy sneakers, for the design, for the stories, and kind of some childhood memories. So this is part one. So I'm coming up on kind of ending part one. So then I go to college, and I went to a small school for 1 year to play baseball. And it was a private Christian school up in Indiana. and decided that even at that level, I just wasn't having fun anymore. And I mean, I had to log like 30 hours a week in the library. I was a pitcher, so we had to run. Pitchers are always, the legs are the most important thing. And so I had to run like 20, 25 miles outside of normal practice. And I had to sign something that also said that I would not play intramural sports, pick up basketball, do anything silly, stupid, dumb. And I was like, man, like, and I was average at best at baseball. And so I was like, man, even at this level, I'm not having fun anymore. So both my parents and my grandmother, actually my mom's mom, went to East Carolina. And my grandmother actually went when it was called East Carolina's Teachers College. And there were 13 girls and like one or two boys. And she was one of the 13 girls. And my parents both went. My cousin was going, was going to be a freshman. I'm 3 months older than him, but a year ahead of him in school. So I was a sophomore. He was entering as a freshman. Actually had a buddy in from Taylor that said, hey, man, if you're going to transfer, I'll transfer you with you. So him and I were roommates when I moved down there. So I went to ECU. Got an undergrad in, what did I do? Oh, marketing. Ah, man. Marketing, and then stayed on and got a master's in business. And again, kind of carried through the entrepreneurship side of everything. I ended up playing in a band, and that's how I made money to afford rent and everything. And then Judd Crumpler, if you're listening to this by chance, opened up 4th Street Tavern. So if you've ever been to Greenville or went to ECU and my age, you probably stepped foot in 4th Street Tavern. So I had met Judd through mutual friends, and he said, hey, man, I know you play in a band and all that stuff, but have you ever DJed? And I was like, well, I like music, but no. And he said, well, I need a DJ, and so I DJed for Judd for a couple years, and that was the best gig. $75 every night, cash, and I would do like two or three nights a week, and he'd basically let me do whatever, play whatever, do whatever, and so that was fun. But when I graduated from ECU with the grad degree and undergrad, I didn't get involved at all. And I did not, and through the band and DJing, and this isn't a flex by any means, but like knew all the bar owners downtown and stuff like that, just from, you know, being in the band, but that didn't help me at all. None of those guys could make phone calls for me and say, hey, you know, I've got this, you know, young kid that's graduating and he needs a job. What I should have done, and I don't really have any regrets, it all worked out the way it's supposed to. But if you are listening to this and you're still in school, what I should have done is get more involved with the university, join a club, you know, do an internship. I didn't even do an internship as an undergrad. And so I had a blank piece of paper as a resume that basically said, cool, you know, I didn't do terrible in school. I graduated 6th in the marketing class and then passed out of a year of grad school. So, I mean, I had that going for me, but nothing else, right? Like, cool, you played in a band and DJed in a bar. Well, that, yes, I'm sure you learned a lot, but that doesn't really show me anything else. So part two will pick up where I had to move back home with my parents back in Indiana. So I had to pack up. I still remember it to this day. And this is not an exaggeration. It was pouring down rain. I'm loading up a U-Haul. I gave Matt Costin, who I was living with at the time, and Corey Houston, who was the lead singer in the band, gave them two giant hugs. Thought I'd never see them probably ever again, or very rare occasions, and got in my truck with the giant U-Haul behind me and headed back out on 264 to drive all the way home to Indianapolis, Indiana, without a job and moving in with my mom and dad.